Saturday, August 21st, 1971.
Today at about 3 p.m., there was an attempted break from our adjustment center, which is our maximum security facility. George Jackson was killed as he broke and ran outside the adjustment center.
Well, I could die tomorrow, but there'll be 200 or 300 people to take my place.
This is one black man they're not going to murder and sweep under the rug, unless they murder me too.
Today we present The Struggle Inside, the 30-year anniversary of the murder of George Jackson, a program about the origins of the modern anti-prison movement. My name is Jonathan Jackson, Jr. In 1960, at the age of 18, George Jackson was accused of stealing $70 from a gas station near Los Angeles. Though there was evidence of his innocence, his court-appointed lawyer maintained that because Jackson had a record, two instances of petty crime, he should plead guilty in exchange for a light sentence in the county jail. He did, and instead received an indeterminate sentence of 1 year to life. Jackson spent the next 10 years in prison, 7.5 of them in solitary confinement. Instead of succumbing to the dehumanization of prison existence, he transformed himself into the leading theoretician of the prison movement and a brilliant writer. On January 16th, 1969, a few days after a prison guard shot and killed three black Soledad inmates, another guard was found beaten to death.
Soledad was a real intense place.
David Johnson, prison activist and former prisoner.
There had been a lot of killings in the hole. Most of the killings had taken place. They were either racial killings, and then there was a couple of instances where guards had, during cell extractions, had tear gas and killed inmates. The tension there was real high. The assassinations on the yards of W.L. Nolan, Alvin Miller, and Cleveland Edwards triggered this whole upheaval in the California penal system.
The three, who became known as the Soledad brothers, were brought in chains and shackles to two secret hearings in Salinas County, and so commenced one of the most extensive legal defenses in U.S. history. The Soledad brothers were charged with murder, not because there was any substantial evidence of their guilt, but because they had been identified as black militants by the prison authorities. If convicted, they would face a mandatory death sentence.
The Soledad brothers all have his basis and his connection with the Black Panther Party.
David Hilliard, Black Panther Party leader.
George, who says himself that it was the Black Panther Party more than anything that gave expression to political prisoners as a voice.
Notice had to be served on the Department of Corrections that you just cannot wantonly kill black people without some type of response. Adhere to Malcolm X's philosophy, there's nothing wrong with self-defense. When those brothers got killed on the yard, the courts ruled that it was justifiable homicide. What alternative do you have as a group?
The Soledad brothers' case emerged as a focal point for a growing movement demanding changes within California prisons. It was a time when the American status quo was shaken by black rebellion in more than 100 cities, as well as the mass movement against the Vietnam War.
These ideas were developed against the backdrop of progressive revolutions transforming the globe.
Angela Davis, prison abolitionist and University of California professor.
The struggles of the Vietnamese people, for example. The fact that increasing numbers of countries in Africa were achieving their independence. And today people tend to think about the movements of the 60s as movements that were very separate, nationalists, racially defined, because they're looking at them through the lens of what is generally considered to be identity politics today. But as a matter of fact, the black power movement per se was not an exclusive movement. There were people of all racial, ethnic backgrounds involved in that movement. There was a connection with global movements. And there was a connection with the Young Lords, the Brown Berets, the American Indian movement. We were part of a global revolution. There was no question about the importance of making those connections and building those bridges.
The prison was our battleground, our battlefield.
David Johnson.
It wasn't in isolation with what was taking place outside, because as people start to raise their voices about civil rights violations and human rights violations, then brothers inside, through civil litigation, through protests, strikes, and stuff like that, fought to gain their civil rights and human rights.
On August 7th, 1970, just a short time after George Jackson was transferred to San Quentin Prison, the Soledad brothers' case was catapulted to the forefront of national news when George's brother, Jonathan, a 17-year-old high school student in Pasadena, led a raid on the Marin County Courthouse with a satchel full of handguns, an assault rifle, and a shotgun hidden under his coat. Educated as a political revolutionary by his brother, Jonathan invaded the court during a hearing for three San Quentin inmates, not including his brother, and handed them weapons. As Jonathan left the courthouse, leading the three prisoners and five hostages, including the judge, he demanded that the Soledad brothers be released. Prison guards and other authorities opened fire on the escape van, killing Jonathan Jackson, William Christmas, James McLean, and the judge. Only one black prisoner, Rochelle McGee, survived what has become known as the Marin County Rebellion. Rochelle McGee.
This is one of the reasons I fight so hard and fight back, and will continue to do so, with the belief that I've always had, as long as you fight, nobody know how the fight gonna come out. It's a possibility I might win, but I know if I stop, I cannot win. I also believe that one man can make a difference if he's sincere.
Of Jonathan, George wrote, "He was free for a while. I guess that's more than most of us can expect." George Jackson, recorded in San Quentin before his murder.
I don't think that it's fair to Jonathan Jackson. I don't think it's fair to William Christmas or to James McLean or Brother McGee. I don't think it's fair at all to try to bury those brothers' examples.
And, you know, Jonathan sacrificed his life for the cause of freeing his brother and all of those who were unjustly imprisoned.
There wasn't one thing that could stop those brothers from attaining what they started out to do. I think it was well thought out. The mistake was in underestimating the viciousness of the prison guards.
David Hilliard.
Jonathan Jackson made an attempt to free George and other political prisoners. Certainly a revolutionary action. Jonathan and the judge and William Christmas and James McLean were all killed in that event. And Rochelle McGee, who still lingers in prison, was also a part of that attempt to free those brothers from prison.
Rochelle McGee, prison activist and jailhouse lawyer, still in prison for his political resistance.
Slavery is something that is being practiced by the system under the color of law. Slavery 400 years ago, slavery today is the same but with a new name. They're making millions and millions of dollars off of enslaving blacks, poor whites, and others daily. Peoples who don't even know that they are being railroaded.
George Jackson.
The only way the oppressor can maintain his position is by fostering, nurturing, building contempt for the oppressed. The brutality really leads to more resistance, and that's what we're working for, revolution. The institutions that buttress the establishment have to be assaulted.
Hugo Pinnell, prison activist and leader, still in prison for his political activities and resistance.
Well, I'm a revolutionary in the sense that I believe that what the word means, to change something, you know, in a big way. There's many changes that got to happen in order for the people on the bottom, the people like black people, Latinos, and you know, in the United States and throughout the world, I feel that there are many things that has to happen before we can get justice.
Political incarceration removes threats to the political and economic hegemony of the United States. Even though in 1959, George Jackson initially went to prison as an everyday lawbreaker with a one-year-to-life sentence, it was his political consciousness that kept him incarcerated for 11 years.
One of the important achievements of the movement during that period was to do what George Jackson called the transformation of a criminal consciousness into a political consciousness.
Angela Davis.
I mean, this was precisely what he took on. And no one can deny that there were many people then, as now, committing antisocial acts against members of their communities, members of other communities.
So that when you leave these institutions and go back to your communities, you can be an asset to your community and not a predator.
David Johnson.
And a lot of brothers embrace that concept.
He did a lot of studying.
Luis Bato Talamantes, prison activist and former prisoner.
And he was persistent in talking to me and other Chicano brothers who had no real interest nor inclination to even be political. We were still kind of like inclined to be criminal.
I would say from 1968 on, I began to grow.
Willie Sundiata Tate, prison activist and former prisoner.
Through other people who was in prison, by them like sharing information and just stimulate me to use my brain to not just exist, you know.
Well, the first 4 years I read in economics, pure economics.
George Jackson.
The second 4 years I read in exclusively in military things, you know, guerrilla warfare, Mao Zedong. I read Nkrumah's stuff. I read Jacques, Vo Nguyen Jacques, People's Army, People's War. I went through the whole gambit, the whole thing, the whole line.
George Jackson always referring to the Vietnamese people soldiers, the Viet Cong as comrades.
Bato Talamantes.
And George Jackson was the one that would, with a nice smile, George Jackson really kind of had a big smile, and he would kind of like get a twinkle in his eye, and he would kind of lead you down this thing going, and show you in very simple, kind of like an educational way so that you didn't feel like he was talking over you or putting you down. He would show you step by step how your mind got manipulated into rooting for the wrong side, see?
Many of us were going into prisons during those days, especially from 1969 through the latter 70s, where some 1,800 arrests. Fred Hampton's murdered in Chicago. Mark Clark is murdered. The eight or nine other Panthers are taken to jails and wounded. The whole New York chapter was under attack and everybody was imprisoned. The wave of repression and war against our Black Panther Party chapter in Los Angeles, where there was this four-hour gun battle. The police shootout with myself and Cleaver, where little Bobby Hutton was killed April 6, 1968. So it was truly a war against our Black communities.
Just like in the South, the Deacons for Defense had to be formed to protect themselves from not only the police, but the attacks of the Klans, as Black people, you know, were in quest of securing their civil rights. So the same thing occurred here in the prison system. It culminated into a militant wing of the prison movement, and their task and responsibility was to protect the rights and lives of Black prisoners at large.
We're just beginning to learn, beginning to relate to each other, learn how to function together.
George Jackson.
We are aware of the fact that the opposition uses the kill off the head principle, kill the body, and we've set up safeguards against that sort of thing. Well, I could die tomorrow, but there'll be 200 or 300 people to take my place.
David Hilliard.
George is certainly a very dangerous man and was targeted for silencing because George is beginning to remold and to create this new man that goes into prison as a criminal, but now coming out as a revolutionary activist.
A year and 2 weeks after the revolutionary takeover in Marin, prison guards at San Quentin ruthlessly murdered George Jackson.
Saturday, August 21st, 1971.
Today at about 3 p.m., there was an attempted break from our adjustment center, which is our maximum security facility. Apparently, a gun was smuggled in and was in the possession of George Jackson. George Jackson was killed as he broke and ran outside the adjustment center.
We were allowed out by the fact that the control box had been opened.
Pato Talamantes.
And we all came out of our cells questioning what was going on. And at that time, we realized that the first floor tier of the adjustment center had in fact been seized by some revolutionary prisoners, one of them George Jackson, that the skeleton crew that had worked on that Saturday, I think consisted of four officers, had been taken hostage and tied up and laid on the floor. And so it was pretty amazing in that very short period of time, which I call the half-hour revolution, when in fact prisoners did manage to overcome their captors and took over the cell block and for a few minutes tasted freedom.
I've been hungry too long. I've gotten angry too often. I've been lied to and insulted too many times. They pushed me over the line. Missing, there can be no retreat. If I leave here alive, I'll leave nothing behind. They'll never count me among the broken men.
Saturday, his life was cut short when he exited the adjustment center door, bolted past the forepost at San Quentin, which is your central control for the guards, and was sighted on and shot and killed by a sharpshooter guard, and he bled to death on the black asphalt.
Mr. Jackson, you've lost two sons under violent circumstances.
That's what the guard said to me last night. We killed one of your sons last year. We got another one this year. You pretty soon won't have any sons left and laugh.
I'm haunted by the face of his mother, because it might be my mother. And I've been haunted by the face of Jonathan, because it could have been my brother.
James Baldwin, writer and social activist, speaking in Paris in 1971.
I want Ronald Reagan to write a letter to me and to George Jackson, telling me exactly what happened in that prison and how he knows. I want Nixon to confirm it, to tell me why we are still in prison and at their mercy. As long as that is so, the entire Western world is doomed.
What is your reaction to yesterday's tragedy?
I think it's the same thing that goes on in the prisons day in and day out.
Georgia Jackson, George and Jonathan's mother, speaking at San Quentin, August 1971.
It's not new. It just happened to be my son this time instead of some other black woman's son or some other white woman's son that they want to kill.
Do you blame anybody for what happened to your son yesterday?
Yes, I blame the prison. I blame the people who run the prison. I blame the governor, the state, and the United States government. I blame them all because they have the power to change these things and don't want to. Can't you understand? They don't want to change them.
James Baldwin.
Beneath the political implications of this bloody event, there's also an anguish which has endured in my country for nearly 400 years. I myself have lived through too many murders and too many assassinations to believe a word that Nixon or Reagan or any of the other American authorities say. For me, there's been Medgar Evers, who was murdered in Mississippi, and Malcolm X, who was murdered in New York, and Martin, who was murdered in Memphis. I know very well what it is like to be a black man in America. I know very well that the intention of the American Republic was to keep black people slaves forever. And I know that now that black people have discovered in their own minds, in their own hearts, that they are not what they are told they were, that America's on the verge of panic, on the verge of civil war.
They set up his murder just like they do everybody else that speaks out against them. And they'll probably do me the same way, because I am going to speak every chance I get. These people have the power to do right. Why don't they do right? Imagine when the American public is going to wake up to the fact that the people who own and run this country don't want to do right. They know they have everybody in this country afraid of them. People don't love this country so much. They're afraid of what their own country will do to them.
All prisons use terror. Oh, it's no other way to hold an individual. Oh, well, let's put it this way. It's no way for a small knot of armed men to hold a huge crowd of armed men. There's no other way besides terror. Fear, you know, threats, terrorism, brutality. The whole thing is based on fear.
A young man by the name of George Jackson in San Quentin wrote this letter to his mother 3 days before he was murdered.
Harry Belafonte, performer and human rights activist.
It was on the occasion of her birthday. Dear Mama, I hope this year's birthday finds you well. I would like to be able to give you things and take you places, but I've been unfortunate and slow learning. But I've learned well. Perhaps next year, I'll be able to give you a villa in Tanzania. On Saturday, August 21st, 1971, Soledad brother George Lester Jackson was shot to death by guards in the prison yard at San Quentin. If they kill me, Mama, he had written home in a letter, I'll just be dead, but I'll never kiss their feet. That Saturday afternoon, Georgia Jackson had rushed to San Quentin to learn of her son's fate. A guard at the gate said, last year we killed one of your sons, and today we killed another. If you aren't careful, you'll have no sons left. Georgia Jackson said to the guard, I have sons throughout the world wherever people are fighting for freedom.
He was very charismatic. People who had the opportunity to meet him in prison were really drawn to him because of his passion, because of his dedication and his determination to work through these questions of revolution.
I had met George when I was like 17 in the segregation unit at Tracy.
Sundiata Tate.
And he always struck me as this incredible, beautiful person. Intellectual giant, but he didn't speak with intellectual words. He spoke in a way that the average person had no problems understanding him. I can even recall when he organized a strike and he got everyone to refuse to eat and throw their trays out on the tier. And he got black brothers to do that, Hispanic brothers to do that, and the few white brothers that was there. He got all of them to participate in this. One of the warrens, assistant warren or something, was supposed to be making an appearance and to show out his pleasure. All of us collectively, when they brought our food, threw it out on the tier. What was going on? We wasn't down with it, and we protested against those conditions, the food that we was given, the lack of sunshine. I just remember him organizing it.
The prison had failed to contain George's enthusiasm and his dedication and his joy, his happiness. Not very many people had the opportunity to know him as a human being.
And 30 years later, he still kind of like inspires me, because I could still see him smiling and giving me encouragement even when he himself was facing the death penalty.
The fact that in California, the prison population has tripled in the last 10 years is merely one sign of the contradictions which are fracturing the nation. that some kind of systemic change couched in the rhetoric of progress occurred in the 60s is a comfortable myth. The United States continues to face or ignore the problems that brought the 60s to the boiling point. Though George Jackson spoke specifically to the issues of his day, his work could have been written at the turn of the millennium. It is imperative that George's message continue to be heard, both by the righteously angry but unchanneled youth and the more cynical, sometimes weary veterans of the struggle. The message must be carried farther than where George bravely left it in August 1971.
Young people should be aware of the legacy of people like George Jackson, without whom we would not be able to do the kind of political work, we wouldn't have the conceptual apparatus that we have now in terms of trying to understand the centrality of the prison in relation to the economy and in relation to the social landscape in general.
A formation grew out of that, you know, in support of George, in support of Jonathan, and it still exists.
David Johnson.
They're still paying that price. They're languishing in these institutions. Some have died. And if something is not done, it would be criminal for no voices to be raised against the brutality, the isolation, the sensory deprivation that takes place, and the flagrant violation of their human rights.
Settle your quarrels. Come together. Understand the reality of our situation. Understand that fascism is already here, that people are dying who could be saved, that generations more will die or live poor, butchered half-lives if you fail to act. Do what must be done. Discover your humanity and your love in revolution. Pass on the torch. Join us. Give up your life for the people. George Jackson. You have been listening to The Struggle Within, produced for the 30th anniversary of the murder of George Jackson by the Freedom Archives. Many thanks to those who contributed their voices to this program and the hard work of Lincoln Bergman, Judy Gerber, Anita Johnson, Andrea Lessler, and Claude Marx. Thanks also to the support of the Paul Robeson Fund. My name is Jonathan Jackson Jr. Both George Jackson and my father left me a great deal. An unmistakable name. A pride that comes from a history of uncompromising resistance. And a commitment to identify and fight injustice at every turn. For further information, please contact us at area code 415-863-9977. Or go on the web at freedomarchives.org.
The height of what some people call the prison movement, some of us try to call the anti-prison movement, was achieved in the aftermath of George Jackson's assassination. And we know that within a few weeks, there was an enormous uprising at Attica, which managed to place these issues on the agenda of the country in a way that had never happened before. The Attica Rebellion also helped to bring people who had never considered associating themselves with prisoners into the campaign.
So when they speak about revolution, they must speak about a change. because we are human beings and we got to be treated like human beings.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such.
If you put people under these kind of conditions, they're going to rebel, you know, and that's what Attica teaches you.
What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed.
This September marks the 30th anniversary of the historic Attica State Prison Rebellion and Massacre. The story of Attica is one of the most heroic and brutal chapters in U.S. history. After a five-day occupation, 43 people were killed, 150 were shot, and 1,289 tortured. As one of the slogans of that time put it, Attica is all of us. On this 30th anniversary, with more than 2 million people now imprisoned in the United States, the true story of Attica, now more than ever, needs to be told. On this program, you will hear the voices of prisoners, including L.D. Barkley, a prison leader who proclaimed the Attica Manifesto to the world and was killed during the massacre. You'll also hear Frank Big Black Smith, who survived the massacre and describes the torture that took place in its aftermath. You'll also hear other prisoners and guards taken hostage during the five-day occupation, as well as Elizabeth Fink and Michael Deutsch, two attorneys among many who defended prisoners charged with the rebellion, gained acquittals and clemencies, then brought and eventually settled damage suits on behalf of the prisoners. Like all mass rebellions, the Attica Rebellion was preceded by a long chain of abuses, years of petition and protest to improve conditions, years of false promises of reform by the prison administration.
We felt that the people should come together and get a better understanding of the conditions here, what was being did to them by the administration.
Attica brother Donald Noble.
So behind this, we would hold meetings in the yard. You know, we would hold open house, and whoever wanted to come to listen to our political ideology, they were welcome. We didn't bar anyone. This was frowned on by the institution, and they would break it up. In order to reach everyone, we had to get along with different factions here, the Muslims and the Five Centers and all the other factions, to become one solid movement. We start talking about a strike. They made a lot of promises about conditions would be better, the food would get better, and, medical conditions would be better. It was a lot of promises. So everyone laid, they waited, you know. And nothing was did. This is when the Attica Liberation Faction began. We wanted to do things diplomatically. You know, we were seeking reform, although many were not in favor of reform because they didn't believe that the people would listen. So we sought support from the entire population.
People were not interested in waiting for change. They wanted to make change.
Attorney Elizabeth Fink.
The prisoners themselves had gone through a number of different routes to try and change the barbaric conditions that were at Attica. The fact that they were forced to work in the metal shop at 107, 108 degrees for 56 cents a day. The fact that most people were Muslims and the major meat that was given was pork. There was no educational programs. There were no third world guards. There was no representation in any kind of parole hearings. There was just nothing. And the situation in the New York State prisons, as in every other prison in every other state, was deeply racist. All the guards were white, and the vast majority of the prisoners were third world. And up until about 1969, at Attica, for example, everybody stays in their block. They eat with their block, they work with their block, and they wreck with their block. And there's only one day a year where you open up the prison, and that was the 4th of July. And they had this institution called Black Ice and White Ice. They'd bring out this ice, and it was white ice, and only the white people could use it. And then they'd bring out this other ice, and it was black ice. That was only the black people. And this lasted until, like, 69.
In the months preceding September 9, 1971, prisoners had written a manifesto protesting conditions and listing grievances. There had been no response from the administration. Then, on August 21, 1971, prison movement leader and writer George Jackson was shot down at San Quentin Prison in California. We hear from Attica prisoners about the response to that assassination.
Things were getting worse. What really solidified things was George Jackson's death. This had a reaction on the people that we were trying to accomplish all along to bring them together. We thought of, well, how could we pay tribute to George Jackson, because a lot of us idolized him, the things that he was doing, the things he was exposing about the system. So we decided that we would have a silent fast that whole day in honor of him. We would wear black armbands. No one was to eat anything that whole day. We noted that if the people could come together for this, then they could come together for other things.
I didn't know anything about, you know, George Jackson. What George Jackson? So we were going to chow that morning, and when we got in the mess, so everything was quiet. Nobody saying nothing. And you talking about 500, 600, 700 people, inmates. Nobody was eating. So I asked one of my buddies, Carlos, I said, what's up, man? He said, shh, be cool, back. I said, I didn't tell you, man. This dude, George Jackson, in California, killing, and man, there's some kind of solidarity. Ain't nobody eating. But then it went away. I didn't eat. We sat down, but it was, woo.
And so they saw the effect of that mass action, joint action, on the administration and the guards, which was total terror. And I believe that it empowered them.
It was a seemingly small repressive incident against a black and white prisoner that triggered the occupation itself. The tensions of the past years and months erupted into a rebellion by prisoners from four cell blocks and the occupation of D Yard by over 1,500 prisoners. Black, Puerto Rican, Native American, and white prisoners joined together over 5 days, proclaiming demands, caring for guards held hostage, and naming a number of prominent progressive activists, lawyers, and journalists as intermediaries as negotiations began. L.D. Barkley read their manifesto.
The entire incident that has erupted here at Attica is not a result of the dastardly bushwhacking of the two prisoners September 8th of 1971, but of the unmitigated oppression wrought by the racist administrative network of this prison throughout the year. We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed. We will not compromise on any terms except those terms that are agreeable to us. We call upon all the conscientious citizens of America to assist us in putting an end to this situation that threatens the lives of not only us, but of each and every one of you. We have set forth demands that will bring us closer to the reality of the demise of these prison institutions that serve no useful purpose to the people of America, but to those who would enslave and exploit the people of America.
The manifesto's been gone out 3-4 months, and nothing has happened. And as I say, the conditions, they just got worse, man.
These prisoners in front of the whole world organized a structure where they had elections in the blocks and people who represented them, and a conglomeration of white people and black people and brown people, all of whom were empowered. And everybody got to watch that over the 5 days, and it was really intense.
Our demands are such. We want complete amnesty, meaning freedom from all and any physical, mental, and legal reprisals. We want now speedy and safe transportation out of confinement to a non-imperialistic country. We demand that the federal government intervene so that we will be under direct federal jurisdiction. We want the governor and the judiciary to guarantee that there will be no reprisals. And we want all facets of the media to articulate this. We guarantee the safe passage of all people to and from this institution. We invite all the people to come here and witness this degradation, so that they can better know how to bring this degradation to an end. This is what we want.
During the occupation, interviews were conducted with prisoners and with guards held hostage.
These people in here are treated like dogs. Not only the black, the Puerto Rican, the black, and the white. And I want everyone to know that we're going to stick together, that we're going to get what we want, or we're going to die here. All of us. My name is Johnny Delgado. I'm a Puerto Rican, and I'm proud to be a Puerto Rican. And I've always been proud to be a Puerto Rican. Now, I'm going to lay it on you the way it is. These people here are trying to kill us. All these dogs up there with all those rifles are trying to kill us. But we ain't going to quit. You know, we're not, why are we not going to quit? Because we're one. We're one unit. We're tired of being beaten. We're tired of being oppressed. We're going to get this if we all have to die. All of us.
What is your name, please?
Frank Straw.
What is your job?
Correction officer.
Now, we want to know exactly what do you think of the way you're treated in here by these men?
We all have been treated 100%. Been fed well, gave us blankets, slept on mattresses while they slept on the ground. Medication was given to us while they didn't get any. They took care of us first. We've been taken care of at least 100%.
How do you think these men should be treated henceforth?
I think they should be treated 150%. I know they have grievances. I know because I work with them. They've got grievances. I know these grievances. We have to tell those people out there about them.
We all wish we could be home. By we, I don't mean 38 of us. I mean all of us. All 1,538 of us.
To the oppressed people all over the world, we have the solution. The solution is unity. I'd like to speak to the brothers in Buffalo. And I want you brothers to get together because we together here. And these people think we shucking and jiving, but we is for real. We are as serious as cancer. We are for real.
Noted radical attorney William Kunstler, one of the intermediaries named by the prisoners, was interviewed just outside Attica State Prison on September 13, 1971. His words proved prophetic.
The commissioner told us last night that he was going through his own ordeal and that he had not made up his mind what to do. We implore him, as we implore him now, to have no force in there. They want to continue to talk. If they go in there, it's going to be a massacre in this prison, and it's on the heads of the authorities if it takes place. And I have nothing but the greatest of sympathy both for the guards and for the inmates inside. Time can produce something here, but a loss of time and a show of force will produce only death and misery, not only here, but I'm sure we'll have a reaction in black ghettos and other areas throughout the country.
Well, is Governor Rockefeller going to come here? Will he consider doing that? Do you think he should come here?
He should come. His refusal to come here is a monstrosity, because what he is saying is kill these men. I have no concern. All I want to do is restore law and order, and I think that's a rotten exchange for lives.
Now, one of the observations... What if the observation helicopters has taken off and with it, now for the first time, one of the large army helicopters has taken off? It is known that the army helicopters are loaded with what is called riot gas, though we're not quite sure what kind of gas it is. Anyway, here come the helicopters, and they are now heading for the prison. One of the large army helicopters now going overhead and over the wall into the prison. Any idea what's going on behind this cover of gas?
I think we're about to witness a massacre. We just tried a man for My Lai and convicted him, and now My Lai number two is taking place. That is an absolute act of bestiality on the part of this man who calls himself an elected official of this state. I hope that the black people of America and the Puerto Rican people of America remember this day.
The helicopter came and dropped the CS gas, and at the exact moment that gas was dropped, they started to shoot. Exactly at that moment, and they cleared the catwalks. They just murdered everybody on the catwalk.
It was a slaughter line, man. It was people were defenseless, all right? They had sticks and homemade weapons to defend themselves, but this doesn't compare, man, with magnums and carbines. Well, this is ridiculous, you know? The next thing I know is this big helicopter flying over us, and tear gas is coming from everywhere. It's a whole lot of shooting carrying on. So naturally, everyone is running for cover, you know? So I'm next to the wall, and I know around me that everyone is hiding their face, and guys are spitting rags and putting it to their nose. But what I know was troopers start coming from everywhere. Then I start seeing these different people fall, you know? They were shot. Guys was losing their hand, shot in the head and the neck.
The power structure, led by Nelson Rockefeller,
attorney Elizabeth Fink,
wanted to show to the world, and certainly to the rebellious forces within his own country, with the advice and consent and affirmation of Richard Nixon, what the price is for rebellion. And so they created this assault force, which was there to murder everybody. There were 4,500 rounds of ammunition fired on a cage of people, and there were 1,289 people in it. They used high-powered rifles with dum-dum bullets that entered and exploded on impact. And they used shotguns with 8 to 12 36 caliber bullets with an indiscriminate 50-yard spread. And the reason why they did all that is because they wanted to kill a lot of people.
Attorney Michael Deutsch.
The state came in with an incredible amount of firepower. The prisoners were essentially unarmed, only had makeshift weapons. After they shot people down, people who were surrendering with their hands in their head, who were lying prone on the ground, were shot. People who were running away were shot in the back. They then proceeded to strip everybody and send them through lines of swinging guards with clubs.
They had officers lined up all in the hall everywhere. You know, you were scared to death because you were stripped naked. You know, all you seen and heard was a lot of nasty words, calling you all kinds of niggas, you know. They calling the black niggas, they calling the white niggas, they calling the Puerto Rican niggas, and so forth, you know.
And took the leaders who they believed were the leaders of the negotiations and put X's on their back.
When I was placed before the war, they put an X on my back. We theorized that this was intentionally done, man, to exterminate us. You know, the state troopers said that if we moved, we were dead people, you know, dead men.
Literally tortured many of them and put them in cells nude, some with bullet wounds still in them. Many didn't get medical care. Many died from bleeding to death because they didn't get proper medical care, even though they knew prior to the time of the assault that they were going to come in that way. They only provided ambulances for the hostages. They had one ambulance for each hostage and no ambulances for the wounded prisoners.
They would line up on two sides. As you would come down, they would hit you with the sticks and the guns, you know, spit at you. If you fall down, four of them would come on top of you and start beating you with the back of the rifle butts, you know. Once you got in the cell, they take you out of the cell. They give you a beating, throw you back in the cell. They wouldn't feed you. When they did feed you, they put their hands in the food, spit in the food, stuff like that, right in front of you, you know. They'd come down and wake you up every few minutes for harassment, shake on the bars, get up, you know. They wouldn't let you sleep. This went on for days. Left the windows open. No clothes. No shoes.
The mass murder that took place on the 13th of September. Cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Attica brother, Frank Big Black Smith.
I am telling you what I seen with my own eyes. I speak of my dead brother, L.D. Barkley. I know for a fact that he was premeditatedly murdered. I know this.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such.
I was taken out of the yard, and I was put on a table, nude. My body, at present, have cigar burns, cigarette burns all over it. My testicles, at times, bother me now. From cigarette butts, sticks, rifles, laying on the table with my head looking up at the catwalk being spit on, hot shells thrown on my body,
I tried to cover up with my pillow. Can you imagine 250 pounds getting under a pillow? State troopers and police came by and said, nigga, get out from under that pillow. We wanted you to have a cover. We would give you one. You gonna die in the morning, nigga, so it don't make no difference. Nowhere, whether you freeze or we kill you. Nigga, black power, huh? Black power, huh? That's all was said to me while I was in that room. Trying to make me be the animal that he is. To reverse the victim to the criminal to the victim.
What happened after Attica, which was that you have this horrendous event where 43 people were killed, where 150 were shot, and where 1,289 were tortured. And the state then spent the next 30 years trying to cover it up. The story of that, of course, is unbelievable. They took bulldozers and they bulldozed the evidence in the yard, which is all the casings and the shotguns and all of the evidence of their murders. They never noted who got one gun. They didn't follow any of the procedures which you're supposed to when you're about to use deadly force, right? Because they didn't want to. All they wanted is for these people to be blown away. And that's what happened. They got blown away.
So the first thing that had to be done was to defend the prisoners. There were 60 prisoners charged with over 1,400 felony counts. So lawyers came from all across the country to set up an Attica Brothers legal defense and essentially put on a coordinated defense to stop the criminal charges. There was a big political movement that worked with the lawyers who said, jail the real criminals, indict Rockefeller, and drop all the charges.
They spent $158 million prosecuting 62 inmates on 42 indictments, the largest set of indictments in the history of the United States. And that took place from 1971 until 1976.
And after many years of struggle, we were able to get all the charges dropped, but a few, and there were clemency given to the few that were convicted.
So after we fought the indictments, then we decided we needed to file a civil suit. And in 1974, we filed a civil suit asking the state of New York to pay us money for the shooting, the murders, and the torture.
And it took us essentially 20 years to begin to tell those stories in court. There was just a tremendous amount of delays caused by the state. The state hired private lawyers who were paid millions of dollars. And after 20 years, we were able to get the case to trial in 91 and 92. And after a five-month trial in which many of the brothers testified, in which National Guard, who came in to help with the medical care, testified, doctors testified, even one or two state police testified, and some correctional guards testified, a jury of people from Buffalo all agreed that the assault itself inflicted cruel and unusual punishment, as well as the reprisals after the assault.
So we were in a catch-22, because the real issue was always whether what happened to them, which was so horrendous, transcended who they were, a bunch of rebellious third world convicts. And in front of regular people, just like us in Buffalo, racist, bad, the answer was yes.
That became a big thing. If a jury in Buffalo can have that kind of education and knowledge about who was wrong and who was right, because the people in the community really, really, really upheld the law.
And so the case went up on appeal, and in what is easily one of the most dishonest decisions that had ever been written, the Court of Appeal reversed all of our verdicts. What we had was a class action, and so we were able to file one suit for everybody who was in DER at the time the shooting started. What the appellate court said was that it was not an appropriate case for a class action and that we would have to do each case individually. So what that meant, we would have to do 1,286 cases rather than one. And after 26 years, 29 or however many years ago, we just did not have the ability to do that, right? And so therefore, they forced us to take $12 million, right, which was an inadequate settlement, but the largest settlement in the history of the American prison movement, but still not justice by any means.
Three juries then found, after hearing the evidence, that there were violations of human rights and constitutional rights. But it was the judicial system, the courts, the men who decide the law, which prevented us from getting justice, essentially. It was not the people who heard the evidence.
As long as you take a man, a person, a woman, and treat them as a beast, you're going to always have a problem in these concentration camps. Because what is happening in these institutions is the most cruel and inhuman punishment and treatment that any person can be exposed to.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such.
People must know that we are dying. We are being murdered every day. That is what's happening in here, in all the Atticas over the world.
The powers that be knew exactly what they were doing. They knew what weapons they were using. They knew what police force were they doing. They wanted that scorching. They could have taken over that yard without a shot, but they didn't want that. They wanted all that carnage so everybody will see what happens when you rebel.
What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed.
Oppressed people, people without power, can make a difference. They were able to get the eyes of the world to look at the prison system and to look at Attica. They sacrificed, in many cases, their lives to do it, but you never give up, and you continue to fight, and you continue to try and expose injustice and make sure that human rights violators can never rest easy.
What I see is this for the people in the street. I see, wake up. Stop hiding. Because the same thing is happening to me is happening to you. And deal. Petition. Rallies. Let the people, let the governor, let the president and people that in a position to do something about this know how you feel about your sons and your daughters that's incarcerated. Other than that, wake up, because nothing comes to a sleeper but a dream.
You've been listening to a special program from the Freedom Archives on the 30th anniversary of the Attica Prison Rebellion. Special thanks to Frank Big Black Smith and Attica attorneys Elizabeth Fink and Michael Deutsch. The program was produced by Lincoln Bergman, Anita Johnson, Andrea Lessler, and Claude Marx. A contribution from the Robeson Foundation made this program possible. You can contact the Freedom Archives at 415-863-9977 or on the web at freedomarchives.org. This is Rhonda Romero. Thanks for listening.